program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockrock from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today, You'll Never Get Off the Dinner Treadmill by Rachel Sugar. A quiet monologue runs through my head at all times. It is this: dinner, 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 dinner. The thing about dinner is that you have to deal with it every single night. Figuring out what to eat is a pleasure until it becomes a constant, low-grade grind. It's not just cooking that wears me down, but the meal planning and the grocery shopping and the soon-to-be-rotting produce sitting in my fridge. It is the time it sucks up during the week. It is the endless mental energy. Huh, I think, at 6 p.m., dicing onions. So, we're still doing this? I can compromise on breakfast. It is absolutely normal to eat the same breakfast every single day for years, and equally normal to eat nothing. Lunch? Eat it? Skip it? Have some carrot sticks? Who cares? Lunch is a meal of convenience, but dinner is special. Dinner isn't just the largest meal in the standard American diet. It is the most important, the most nourishing, the most freighted with moral weight. The mythical dream of dinner is that after a hard but wholesome day at school or work, the family unit is reunited over a hot meal, freshly prepared. Even if you're dining solo, dinner tends to be eaten in a state of relative leisure, signaling a transition into the time of day when you are no longer beholden to your job. You could eat a full bag of Doritos, Margot Finn, a food studies scholar at the University of Michigan, told me, but that doesn't quite cut it for dinner. There's some paucity there. There's some lack. The dinner problem might be especially acute for working parents like me. Children are unrelenting in their demand to eat at regular intervals, but it spares almost no one. Disposable income helps mitigate the issue. Disposable income helps mitigate most issues, but short of a paid staff, money does not solve it. I could accept this as the price of being human if everywhere I looked there was not someone promising a way out. The sheer number of hacks and services and appliances and startups suggest that some kind of dinner resolution is forthcoming. How could it not be solvable with this many options? We are living in what might be the world historic peak of dinner solutions. A whole canon of cookbooks is devoted to quick and easy weeknight dinners for busy families, and entire freezer cases dedicated to microwavable meals. There is takeout and prepared food and DoorDash and a staggering number of prep guides outlining how to cook in bulk one day a week. And yet, none of it has managed to solve the problem. Dinner exists, daunting and ominous. As it stands, dinner is a game of trade-offs. You can labor over beautiful and wholesome meals, but it is so much work. You can heat up a Trader Joe's frozen burrito or grab McDonald's. There is a reason that, as of 2016, the last time the government counted, one-third of American adults ate fast food on any given day. But you don't have to be a health fanatic to aspire to a more balanced diet. You could get takeout, but it's notoriously expensive and frequently soggy, more a novelty than a regular occurrence. Delivery apps, at least, offer the promise of extreme convenience, except that they are even more expensive, and the food is often even soggier. In spite of all these options, if you cannot free yourself from dinner, you're not alone. The many attempts to make dinner painless have not lived up to their promise. Remember Soylent? One of the bolder possibilities for a while was a shake that pledged to make things a lot less complicated by replacing conventional food with a deconstructed slurry of nutrients. I do want things to be less complicated, but I also want variety. I want to chew. A lot of other people seem to want those things too, which is presumably one reason food-based dinner persists and Soylent has mellowed into a nutritional supplement lifestyle brand. Given the general enthusiasm for eating, most proposed innovations have focused on easing the labor of making dinner. Grocery stores offer pre-chopped produce. Whole Foods briefly experimented with an on-site produce butcher who would slice or dice or julienne your vegetables. Meal kits that ship proportions ingredients to your doorstep ought to be an obvious solution, and for a minute, it seemed like they were. In 2015, Blue Apron was valued at $2 billion, and, according to TechCrunch, was poised to reach 99% of potential home cooks. It did not, in fact, reach 99% of potential home cooks, nor did any of its competitors. There are still people who really love meal kits, Jeff Wells, the lead editor of Grocery Dive, a trade publication, told me. There just aren't that many of them relative to the overall food shopping population. The problem is the cost, or the menu, or the quality, or the lack of leftovers, or the prep time. When one dinner solution fizzles, there is always another and another, which will be superseded by still more. Lately, Wells said, grocery stores have been investing in their prepared-to-go options, with in-store pizza counters and plastic clamshells of deli salads and ready-to-heat containers of spaghetti. Everywhere I look, I seem to be inundated with new and somehow improved solutions. On Instagram, I learned about a new delivery service that is in the process of expanding to my area. While streaming a movie, I was introduced repeatedly to a company that sells healthy meals I could have ready in 2 minutes. Every time I turn on a podcast, I am informed about a meal kit company that, if I use the promo code, will give me free dessert for life. They all promise the same thing, that dinner could be painless if I let it. I could have it all, my dinner and my sanity. Of course, all of these options still require divesting from the Norman Rockwell dream of home-cooked dinner. The idea of dinner has made me resentful and occasionally unpleasant, and at the same time, I viscerally do not want to eat a vat of pre-cooked spaghetti. I can make spaghetti, I thought. But then I was back where I began. Most of us have two basic choices. You can make the necessary compromises and accept something less than optimal, or you can surrender to a wholesome trap of your own making. You can buy the pre-chopped onions, or you can suck it up and chop your own onions. Those are the choices. The notion that there is a permanent way out, a hack, a kit, a service that gives you all of the benefits of dinner cooked from scratch without the labor, is an illusion. You cannot have a meal that is both is and is not homemade. Schrodinger's salmon over couscous with broccoli ribeye. Dinner resists optimization. It can be creative. It can be pleasurable. None of this negates the fact that it is a grind. It always will be a grind. You will always have to think about it, unless you have someone else to think about it for you. And it will always require too much time, or too much energy, or too much money, or some combination of the three. It is unrelenting, in a way that breathing is unrelenting. There is freedom in surrendering to this, that even in this golden age of technological progress, dinner refuses to be solved. Our second article is, Climate Models Can't Explain What's Happening to Earth. This was written by Zoe Schlanger. 50 years into the project of modeling Earth's future climate, we still don't really know what's happening, or what's coming, rather. Some places are warming with more ferocity than expected. Extreme events are taking scientists by surprise. Right now, as the bald reality of climate change bears down on human life, scientists are seeing more clearly the limits of our ability to predict the exact future we face. The coming decades may be far worse and far weirder than the best models anticipated. This is a problem. The world has warmed enough that city planners, public health officials, insurance companies, farmers, and everyone else in the global economy want to know what's coming next for their patch of the planet. And telling them would require geographic precision that even the most advanced climate models don't have yet, as well as computing power that doesn't yet exist. Our picture of what is happening, and probably will happen on Earth, is less hazy than it's ever been. Still, the exquisitely local scale on which climate change is experienced and the global purview of our best tools to forecast its effects simply do not line up. Today's climate models very accurately describe the broad strokes of Earth's future, but warming has also now progressed enough that scientists are noticing unsettling mismatches between some of their predictions and real outcomes. Kai Kornhuber, a climate scientist at Columbia University, and his colleagues recently found that, on every continent except Antarctica, certain regions showed up as mysterious hotspots, suffering repeated heat waves worse than any model could predict or explain. Across places where a third of humanity lives, actual daily temperature records are outpacing model predictions, according to forthcoming research from Dartmouth's Alexander Gottlieb and Justin Mankin. On a global jump in temperature, and a global jump in temperature that lasted from mid-2023 to this past June remains largely unexplained, a fact that troubles Gavin Schmidt, a director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, although it doesn't entirely surprise him. From the 1970s on, people have understood that all models are wrong, he told me, but we've been working to make them more useful. In that sense, the project of climate modeling is a scientific process that's proceeding normally, even excellently. Only now the whole world needs very specific information to make crucial decisions, and they needed it like yesterday. That scientists don't have those answers might look like a failure of modeling, but really it's a testament to how bad climate change has been permitted to get and how quickly. The Earth is an unfathomably complex place, a nesting doll with systems within systems. Feedback loops among temperature, land, air, and water are made even more complicated by the fact that every place on Earth is a little different. Natural variability and human-driven warming further alter the rules that govern each of those fundamental interactions. Some of these systems, such as cloud formation, are notoriously poorly understood, despite having a major bearing on climate change. And, like clouds, many parts of the Earth's system are just too localized for climate models to pick up on. We have approximate cloud formation because we don't have all the small scales necessary to resolve individual water droplets coming together, Robert Rode, a chief scientist at the open-source environmental data nonprofit Berkeley Earth, told me. Similarly, models approximate topography because the scale at which mountain ranges undulate is smaller than the resolution of global climate models, which tend to represent Earth in, at best, 100 square kilometer pixels. That resolution is good for understanding phenomena such as Arctic warming over decades, but you can't resolve a tornado worth anything, Rhodes said. Models simply can't function on the scale at which people live, because assessing the impact of current emissions on the future world requires hundreds of years of simulations. Modeling the Earth at 1 square kilometer pixels would take like 100,000 times more computation than we currently have, Schmidt of NASA told me. Still, global climate models can be of local use if combined with enough regional data and the correct expertise, and more people now want to use them that way in order to understand risk to their properties and investments, or to make emergency plans and build infrastructure. We are asking a lot of the models. more than we have in the past, Rhodes said. For non-scientists, coaxing useful information from climate models requires professional help. Climate scientists have been working for years with New York City to help direct choices, such as where to put infrastructure with sea level rise in mind. But, Schmidt said, there's just not enough scientists to be on the advisory board of every locality or every enterprise or every institution or every company. Helping them assess the right climate data or pick which models to rely on. Some are better at simulating certain variables, such as day-to-night temperature variation, than others. Often governments end up running to private sector companies that claim to be able to translate the data. Schmidt would rather see his own field produce work that is more directly useful to the public. At the same time, now that the models are running up against the reality of dramatic climate change, some of their limits are showing. When this scientific endeavor first started, the models were meant to imagine what global temperatures might look like if greenhouse gas emissions rose, and they did a remarkable job of that. But models are, even now, less capable of accounting for secondary effects of those emissions that no one saw coming, and that now seem to be driving important change. Some of those variables are missing from climate models entirely. Trees and land are major sinks for carbon emissions, and that this fact might change is not accounted for in climate models. But it is changing. Trees and land absorbed much less carbon than normal in 2023, according to research published last October. In Finland, forests have stopped absorbing the majority of the carbon they once did, and recently became a net source of emissions, which, as The Guardian has reported, swamped all gains in the country has made in cutting emissions from all other sectors since the early 1990s. The interactions of ice sheets with the oceans are also largely missing from models, Schmidt told me, despite the fact that melting ice could change ocean temperatures, which could have significant knock-on effects. Changing ocean temperature patterns are currently making climate modelers at the National Association of Astronomics rethink their models of El Niño and La Niña. The agency initially predicted that La Niña's cooling powers would kick in much sooner than it now appears they will. Biases in climate models go in both directions. Some overestimate risk from various factors, while others underestimate it. Some models run hot, suggesting more warming than what actually plays out. But the recent findings about temperature extremes point in the other direction. The models may be underestimating future climate risks across several regions because of a yet unclear limitation. And, as Rhoda said, underestimating risk is far more dangerous than overestimating it. For Kornhuber, too, that models already appear to be severely underestimating climate risk in several places is a bad sign for what's ahead and our capacity to see it coming. It should be worrying that we are now moving into a world where we've kind of reached the limit of our physical understanding of the Earth system, Kornhuber said. While models struggle to capture the world we live in now, the planet is growing more alien to us, further from our reference ranges, as the climate keeps changing. If given unlimited time, science could probably develop models that more fully captured what we're watching play out. But by then, it would be too late to do anything about it. Science is more than five decades into the modeling endeavor, and still our best tools can only get us so far. At the end of the day, we are all making estimates of what's coming, Rhodes said, and there is no magic crystal ball to tell us the absolute truth. We're left instead with a partial picture, gestural in its scope, pointing toward a world we've never seen before. Today's third story. Americans with Dementia Are Grieving Social Media, by Talia Barrington. It took my father nearly 70 years to become a social butterfly. After decades of tinkering with Photoshop on a decrepit Macintosh, he upgraded to an iPad and began uploading collages of photos he took on nighttime walks around London to Flickr and then to Instagram. The likes came rolling in. A photographer from Venezuela applauded his composition. A violinist in Italy struck up a conversation about creativity. And then, as quickly as he had made his new friends, he lost them. One night in 2020, he had a seizure. Then he began forgetting things that he'd just been told and sleeping most of the day. When he picked up his iPad again, it was incomprehensible to him. A year or so later, he put an electric kettle on the gas stove. Not long after, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. An estimated 7 million Americans aged 65 and older are currently living with Alzheimer's. By 2050, that number is expected to rise to nearly 13 million. Millions more have another form of dementia or cognitive decline. These diseases can make simple tasks confusing, language hard to understand, and memory fleeting, none of which is conducive to social connection. And because apps and websites constantly update, they pose a particular challenge for patients who cannot learn or remember, which means that people like my father, who rely heavily on social media to stay in touch, may face an even higher barrier to communication. When my father turned on his iPad again about a year after his seizure, he couldn't find the Photoshop app because the logo had changed. Instagram, which now had reels and a shopping tab, was unnavigable. Some of his followers from Instagram and Flickr had moved on to a new app, TikTok, that he had no hope of operating. Whenever we speak, he asks me where his former life has disappeared to. Where are my photos? Why did you delete my profile? I wrote a reply to a message. Where is it gone? Of all the losses caused by Alzheimer's, the one that seems to have brought him to the most angst is that of the digital world he once mastered and his abilities to create and connect that it had afforded him. In online support forums, caretakers of Alzheimer's and dementia patients describe how their loved ones struggled to navigate the platforms they were once familiar with. One member of the dementia subreddit site, who requested not to be identified out of respect for her father's privacy, told me that about a decade ago, her father had been an avid emailer and used a site called Friends Reunited to recall the past and reconnect with old acquaintances. Then he received his dementia diagnosis after back-to-back strokes. His PC now sits unused. Amy Evans, a 62-year-old in Sacramento, told me that her father, who passed away in May at the age of 92, started behaving erratically online at the onset of Alzheimer's. He posted on Facebook that he was looking for a sex partner. Then he began responding to scam emails and ordering, among other things, Xanax from India. Evans eventually installed a child protection software on his computer and gave him a grand pad to connect with family and friends. But he kept forgetting how to use it. Nazrin Chowdhury, a former public school teacher's aide who lives in New York City, once used Facebook to communicate daily with family and friends, but now, after a stroke and subsequent Alzheimer's diagnosis at 55, she will sit for hours tapping the screen with her finger, even if nothing is there, her daughter, Ashita Nursat, told me. I'll come home from work and she'll say she texted me, and I never replied. Then I'll look at her phone and she tried to type it out in YouTube and post it as a video. Chowdhury's other daughter, Saloa Jessica, said, now Chowdhury takes calls with the aid of her family, but she told me that because she can't use social time, she feels she has no control over her own life. Many patients with dementia and related cognitive disorders lose the ability to communicate, regardless of whether they use technology to do it. It's a vicious cycle, Joel Salinas, a clinical assistant professor of neurology at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, told me, because social disconnect can, in turn, hasten the cognitive degeneration caused by Alzheimer's and dementia. Social media, by its very nature, is an especially acute challenge for people with dementia. The online world is a largely visual medium with a complex array of workflows, and dementia commonly causes visual processing to be interrupted or delayed. And unlike face-to-face conversation, landlines, or even flip phones, social media is always evolving. Every few months, on a given platform, buttons might be changed, icons reconfigured, or new features released. Tech companies say that such changes make the user experience more seamless, but those with short-term memory loss can find the user experience downright impossible. On the whole, social media companies have not yet found good solutions for users with dementia. Joanne Jewett, Meta's Enterprise Product Manager for Accessibility, told me, I would say that we're tackling more of the loss of vision, the loss of hearing, mobility issues, she said. Design changes that address such disabilities might help many dementia patients who, thanks to their advanced age, have limited mobility. But to accommodate the unique needs of an aging and cognitively disabled users, Jewett believes AI might be crucial. If, let's say, Windows 7 is gone, AI could identify my patterns of use and adapt Windows 11 for me. Jewett also told me that her 97-year-old mother now uses Siri to make calls. It allows her to maintain social ties even when she can't keep track of the phone app where the phone app lives on her iPhone screen. The idea of a voice assistant that could reconnect my father to his online world is enticing. I wish he had a tool that could allow him to connect in the ways that once gave him joy. Such solutions will become only more necessary. Americans are, on average, getting both older and more reliant on technology to communicate. The oldest Americans, who are most likely to experience cognitive decline, came to social media later in life, and still nearly half of the population over 65 uses it. Social media is an inextricable part of how the younger generations connect. If a particular loneliness of forgetting how to use social media is already becoming apparent, what will happen when an entire generation of power users comes of age? We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.